Welcome back to the program. Back in 1848, John Stuart Mill said the following: "It is hardly possible to overstate the value of placing human beings in contact with persons dissimilar to themselves, and with modes of thought and action dissimilar to themselves, and with modes of thought and action unlike those with which we are familiar. Such communication has always been, and is particularly in the present age, one of the primary sources of progress. Given the globalized nature of our world today, nothing could be more true even 164 years later. My guest today, Jesse Eisenstadt, has done exactly that. Using his love of surfing, he forged a common bond with the disparate people of the Middle East and proved beyond a shadow of a doubt the ability of our common humanity to transcend those man-made constructs that divide us. It is my pleasure to welcome Jesse Eisenstadt to the program today to talk about his new work, Surfing the Middle East, Deviant Journalism from the Lost Generation. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, brilliant introduction. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, and good to have you here. This all started out because you graduated college like a lot of young people today and couldn't find a job.
Yeah, that's true. In 2009, in May, I was graduating, and the recession was particularly intense then, and I couldn't find a job, so I landed this freelance assignment to surf from Israel to Lebanon. This whole idea came basically across from watching the 2006 war on television, watching Israel shoot rockets into Lebanon, Hezbollah in Lebanon shoot rockets into Israel, and I just felt just sick, you know, just sitting on my college, dorm apartment thing, just felt sick about it. And I thought, how radical would it be to try and kind of humanize this part of the world that we seem to just really only get the militarized version of here in North America?
And what you engaged in is a kind of participatory journalism. I mean, you wrote about this as you were there, as you were interacting with people and surfing your way across the Middle East.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the whole idea is to take these abstractions, you know, that when we think of Israelis or Muslims or Jews or Palestinians, whatever, and you know, find human elements within them and meet these people who live there and get kind of a original source reporting on the ground that really gives people, readers of the book, an insight into kind of what's really going on in the Middle East, but not from like a preachy perspective, but just kind of like, here's an authentic experience about me, this young 20-something, basically going to find waves and freelancing articles as a journalist. And this is just my experience, but I'm sure you could have your own too.
Beyond the commonality of surfing, there was also this sense that you talk about that this was a place and a subject that had a certain universality, that wherever you went, whether you were in Santa Barbara, whether you were in Napa, wherever you were, that people talked about whatever they talked about, plus they talked about the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, totally hit the nail on the head there. It's an incredible region, and there's this duality that exists that seems strange to the California surfer, and that's the fact that there's this kind of relaxed surf culture or just kind of hanging out on the beach, which is very recognizable to, you know, growing up here in Santa Barbara, California, where I'm from. But then there's this other, you know, duality or dichotomy or whatever fancy word with a D you want to use. But it's that there is no peace along the Eastern Mediterranean, and that you're really in rocket country, and just like in 2006, rockets could come raining down at any time.
To what extent did you think about that famous scene from Apocalypse Now, where we see surfing in the middle of a war, essentially?
Yeah, that's incredible. I was doing the Dennis Miller show a few weeks ago, and he asked me the same question. He's a lover of Apocalypse Now. And that really was a major inspiration for part of the trip, you know. So to surf from Israel to Lebanon, you're really just going 30 miles north across a closed border, but you can't go across that closed border, so you have to do this whole inland route through the West Bank, Jordan, you know, fly over Syria, and land Beirut, and it's this whole kind of dance, or how I thought it, journey on on that boat they use in Apocalypse Now until you get to the end, which is the final place I end up surfing with my Lebanese buddy, completing the trip from Israel to Lebanon. And I really felt like I'd entered Kurtz's compound. And along the way, of course, you're seeing, you know, partial remnants of war or this is and that. And the whole time I felt like I was on that boat, on that journey. And it was profound, you know, it was really incredible.
And in fact, you were surfing in some places, literally with rockets overhead.
Yeah. In northern Israel, for example, I met up with this guy, Lee, who was this Israeli surfboard shaper slash, you know, ultimate dude. Like most young Israeli men, he was in the army, and he kind of left that, you know, he didn't really want to get into that with me, but we ended up hanging out for a few weeks in Haifa, and one day after, in northern Israel, one day after a surf, he wheels his little car, his little Japanese four-cylinder off the road, and takes me up upon this, like, knoll, this grassy knoll, like, in the middle of kind of the outskirts of Haifa. And, you know, he says, get out. And he starts running up this knoll, and I kind of follow him. And when we get to the top, I see this little stubby pipe. And I'm thinking, did he just do all this for a pipe? And he says, look down again. And he says, this pipe is the bottom of what used to be a sign that was hit by a rocket in the 2006 war. And this is kind of all that's left, this stubby little pipe. He said, I want you to remember that this could happen anywhere at any time, you know, especially where we are in this knoll. We're open to the north here, and that's where the rockets are in South Lebanon.
One of the other things you talk about is surfing as a kind of metaphor, that it was that you look at surfing as kind of this battle against mortality.
Yeah, a raging battle against mortality. And I think that this is kind of a pure Steve Jobs lesson I learned somewhere along the way. But you realize that there are these rules to the game that exist in how we live our lives. And people say, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. And when in fact these rules are most of the time made up by people no smarter than you are. And as soon as you realize that, there's a kind of a radical strain that sets you free. And you realize that you can kind of do whatever you want because you are in dictation of your own destiny, or at least a lot of it. And that's what surfing kind of worked for as me. You know, it was a metaphor for really putting into question what I could do, both in the physical sport of catching waves, but in also trying to basically tell the story or experience the story of two countries that just shoot rockets at each other. And that was kind of the twisted thesis, I guess, to get into this to begin with.
What did you know about the region? What preconceptions, if any, did you have about what you were getting into?
Yeah, so I'm kind of like a obsessive fanatic in a lot of ways. And what happened in 2 years prior to doing this trip, I did a study abroad to Greece and Turkey and ended up going into Lebanon, traveling around the Middle East, and ended up working at a refugee camp in the West Bank right when Hamas and Fatah were clashing, when Hamas took over the Gaza Strip. So, and Hamas tried to take over the West Bank too at that time. So it was pretty crazy. And that was kind of my first, you know, on-the-ground encounter with the Middle East. But for years prior to doing this, I would write freelance in college, out of college, and that was just my obsession. It's the Middle East is the story of my generation. I'm 27 now. And I was just on KRON, the San Francisco Morning Show, a few weeks ago. And I just said, hey, guys, look at the news this morning. Look at the A block. You know, it is the Middle East. This is a local news station, and yet we talk about the Middle East. It is front and center. And now, of course, we're talking about, will Bashar al-Assad in Syria use chemical weapons? You know, it's a scary neighborhood, but it's a scary neighborhood that deserves a human understanding of it, because the danger is when we see it in abstractions, and then everything can deteriorate rather quickly from then.
Talk about some of the other dangers that you faced. You were tear gassed on the West Bank, and you carried multiple identities as you traveled around.
Yeah. So on the West Bank was part of the route I had to take because I couldn't just go, you know, tens of miles up the coast from Israel to Lebanon. So I'm going around the closed border, and some of my friends actually that I had met in Nablus on the West Bank a few years earlier, you know, are working there as journalists, and they go to cover this rally where these Palestinians protest the wall of separation that, you know, divides the West Bank from Israel proper. And like clockwork, after the prayer finishes in the small village of Bilin, everyone marches to the wall separation and starts protesting and throwing rocks and whatnot. And then the Israelis come in and tear gas the scene. But, you know, we were in there as journalists trying to get pictures, which is a number. I'm actually looking at a picture of that in my book right now. And it just runs like clockwork. The Palestinians are trying to show sort of the inhumanity of the occupation, and the Israeli army is trying to enforce it. And every Friday around lunchtime, or I guess just before lunchtime, in the small village of Bilin, this happens. And getting tear gassed is a miserable experience. It's like getting waterboarded with lime juice in... All of your just, you know, orifices on your face are just an overload, and it hurts like hell.
You talk about some Israeli surfers that took you around, that showed you the sights, and clearly it wasn't like surfing in California by any means.
One of the most surprising things about surfing the Middle East is that it's a journalistic tool to kind of tell a story, or I guess experience a story, but it also gives you this insight because you're not just stiffen everyone to death wearing a necktie in a formal interview. Mm-hmm. And an example of that is the Israeli surfers took me to this Hills party, which is like a bunch of African drums, guitar, just a bunch of guys hanging out, very recognizable, slightly counterculture scene that you'd experience in California. And all of a sudden, I get in this conversation with this guy who was a commando, Israeli commando, now, you know, Haifa surfer, but Israeli commando during the Gaza War in Operation Cast Lead in Gaza a few years ago. And he basically, you know, he's definitely been doing a good amount of drinking, and that scene in the book, we kind of slur his words a little bit. But he basically confirms this report that one of my friends, who's a journalist on the West Bank, and I had been puzzled about, which is that these Israeli units went into Gaza and then took over these Palestinians' apartments, but some of them, when they left, when the war was over, they either sacked the apartment and, you know, destroyed everything, or they did the laundry, washed the dishes, and left it exactly how they found it. And it was very bizarre, because you just don't expect anyone in the army to be like a bed maker. You know, you expect it to be this hard, kinetic machine that fights to win. And basically what the guy blurted out was, I was a Gaza maid. And he said it all came down to the commander of the unit. He said, you know, some of the units demanded that their soldiers fix these apartments just the way they found them, because that's what they wanted to do, you know, because they thought, oh, we are members of the Israeli army, this is what they do. Other units spread human excrement on the wall. And he confirmed that was kind of the reality on the ground. But then when the report came in during the Gaza War, we had no idea what to think about this. The Israeli government, the Israeli army as bed makers? You know, it seemed ridiculous.
One of the things that you talk about that was confusing, I suppose, in some ways, is that when we look at events there from here, we tend to want to put everything into categories. We want to simplify everything. And as you became deeper involved in the humanity over there, you realized that it wasn't so simple.
It was not so simple. The Middle East is a very old region, and I mean that in the best possible sense. You know, it's so easy to get enchanted by the culture, or just like Jerusalem, for example. It's just kind of a twisting complexity. some people say that it's two or three nations or whatever sitting side by side. Well, it's actually more like 20 empires at least sitting right on top of each other. And that's just what Jerusalem is. And that kind of ancient complexity is just seen all over the place.
What did you come to understand about what the conflicts were about and what the battles were about?
Yeah, that's a question that I've struggled with for a long time. I think that it's very easy, again, from North America, where, you know, where we are, to see it as an abstraction. It's like the Israelis are like this, the Palestinians are like this. In northern Israel, in Haifa, I ended up surfing with these guys. One was an Arab, the other guy was Jewish, and they just happened to be best friends because they were they believed in their friendship and surfing and just kind of existing. And, like, what do they care if the other guy is of a different ethnicity? You know, they still do the same things. Like, it wasn't like you audit someone's ethnicity to go surfing, right? It's ridiculous. But then when you go to other places that have maybe a more polarized past, like Beirut, Lebanon, where the civil war and the screwy constitution the French left helped facilitate this breakdown along sectarian lines, then it's like you have people of different sects just hating each other because I think of historically, you know, what has happened. I don't think there's anything innate in anyone that, you know, makes an Arab hate a Jew or a Druze militiaman in Lebanon, you know, hate a Shia Muslim or anything. It's a shared history, or a history, I guess.
And when you were with both groups, when you were with Palestinians and Israelis, and you were surfing together, mm-hmm. talk about that common bond.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I was just talking about that Arab and Jewish guy. The Jewish guy was this guy, Lee, I was just saying, who marched me up that mm-hmm. knoll of the rocket. And the Arab guy was this guy named Rafouf, and he just invited us over one day to his house for these, like, really great celery drinks he made. And, you know, we're just sitting on top of his, like, seafront, ancient kind of white rock apartment studio kind of thing, just kind of looking out at the Mediterranean. And I just asked him flat out, I was like, hey, look, you know, I'm from the United States. I'm just asking, like, just completely pardon my ignorance. I'm just asking, you know. Is it a problem that you guys are from different, you know, parts of the community to kind of be politically correct about it? And he said, no, that's ridiculous. That is absolutely ridiculous. And he points out to the kind of molten ball of the sun setting into the Mediterranean. You can see the beautiful waves who are just surfing. And, you know, he just says, this is what binds us. And it was just one of those, like, the ending of the first act or kind of thing. It was a grand moment when he said that. And, yeah, I mean, people with commonalities and common bonds seem to tend to want to get along more than to not. And I think that should be realized whenever anyone ever decides to get around to trying to figure out a solution between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Of course, you got a big dose of reality when you went into a Palestinian refugee camp.
Yeah, I would say that the real untold tragedy, like who really has it the worst in the whole Eastern Mediterranean region, and, you know, this might quickly change because of Syria and what's going on there, but it's the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, because Lebanon is pretty much a dysfunctional state to begin with. And the Palestinian refugees, I went to the Sabah Shatila refugee camp south of Beirut, you know, in 82, 83, there was a tragedy, September 16th, I believe, when Christian phalangist Lebanese militiamen went in and just butchered, you know, we don't really know how many Palestinians, maybe up to 4,000 is what's said, in one day. It's the single greatest loss of life in the Arab-Israeli conflict, or in the the Arab-Israeli conflict to date. And you go in there, and you're walking across a mass grave, and you just see these homes built in with no planning or no real intent of even staying there, because it's a refugee camp, right? These Palestinians, they think they're going to get naturalized in Lebanon. They think they might go back to the West Bank or Gaza. They think they might go back to what was once Palestine. But they're definitely not thinking they're going to stay in this camp. So you have all these makeshift homes with people tapping each other's electricity line, just, you know, like themselves doing it. There's no grid monitoring any of it. Homes fall down all the time because the concrete is terrible. And it's really one of the worst places in the world. And to extend the apocalypse now metaphor, which I used kind of at the end, I mean, that was Kurtz's compound. I end up sitting face to face with this old dude, maybe 70-something years old, just pious Muslim cap on. And he's looking at me and he says, "Hey, I was from Haifa. I was born in Haifa, where you just were. And, like, now I'm here." And I'm sitting there just without even kind of the heart to tell him what it now looks like or anything. And this man still thinks, you know, he still had his, like, memorabilia from his house there. And you could just kind of see the tragedy of the conflict. It's just that there's displaced people, and he's trapped in a camp. He cannot leave the Savage Steel refugee camp in South Beirut, Lebanon.
You were over there for 6 months. Any plans to go back?
Yeah, I'd really love to go back. I'd love to get into the documentary filmmaking field, because writing about it was, you know, was an up and down and really an exciting thing. That quote you used to open our segment was just brilliant. But I would love to go back. I would love to continue to better understand and really communicate, help Americans really understand what's going on in the Middle East, and from a really accessible, fun, engaging, but also scary as hell kind of way.
Jesse Eisenstadt, the book is Surfing the Middle East, Deviant Journalism from the Lost Generation. Your blog that is still ongoing is
bloggingthecaspa.com.
Jesse Eisenstadt, Surfing the Middle East, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Hey, thank you. It was a pleasure.